Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. Rabbi Meir Schweiger's construction is continuing, and so unfortunately, he does not have a new podcast for us this week. Instead, here is a reprised version of his podcast for Ki Tetzeh from last summer. Also, I want to apologize on the delay in getting this podcast out. My plan is to have them out on Tuesday or Wednesday, and I am regretful that it was not possible to do that this week. Now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger on Ki Tetzeh. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member of Pardes and serves as a Mashgiach Ruhani, the spiritual guide for Pardes.
This week's parsha is Parshat Ki Tetzeh. Parshat Ki Tetzeh is one of three parshiot in the Torah that have the bulk of laws which are generally referred to as Ben Adam L'Chavero, interpersonal relations. The other two parshiot being Parshat Mishpatim in the book of Shemot and Parshat Kedoshim in the book of Vayikra. Although our parsha focuses on a whole variety of laws that have to do with day-to-day practices, there are two major topics that are interwoven in this parsha: warfare and problematic sexual relations. Some people might say sex and violence. The theme of warfare comes up in the beginning, middle, and end of the parsha. The parsha begins in chapter 21, verse 10, Ki tetzeh lamilchama al oyvecha, when you will go out in battle against your enemies, unetano Hashem elokecha biyadecha, and the Lord your God will give him into your hand, v'shavita shivyo, and you will take a captive. The end of the parsha discusses remembering Amalek, a passage that we read the Shabbat before Purim, chapter 25, verses 17 through 19. I would like to begin by looking at the middle of the parsha. This is chapter 23, verses 10 through 15. When your camp goes out against your enemies, v'nishmarta, you should guard yourself, mikol davar ra, from all, any. And the word davar here could mean matter or speech. Any evil matter or any evil speech. And then the Torah goes on to give two regulations of the Jewish military camp, two expectations of what our camp should look like. The first, in verses 11 and 12, if there is a man who is impure as a result of mikre laila, a chance happening of the evening, which the rabbis understand to be a nocturnal seminal emission, such an individual is ritually impure. And what the Torah says is, he is to be sent out of the military camp, and he is not allowed to re-enter until he has gone through a complete purification process, which entails ritual immersion and waiting until the following evening before he can return. The second regulation, and this is verses 13 and 14, is that the bathroom facilities must be outside of the camp. One cannot, should not, tend to their bodily needs within the camp. Moreover, each soldier is to have with him a spade, a shovel, which he will use to dig a hole and thereby cover up his excrement. These two regulations reflect a rabbinic concept known as Kedusha Unikiyut, holiness and cleanliness, which are supposed to be at the core of the military camp. The explanation offered in verse 15 for these regulations is that the Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp to save you and to give your enemies before you. Hence, your camp shall be holy. so that God will not see in you any form of nakedness and turn away from you. If we look at the example of the nocturnal emission, there is an interesting parallel between the military camp and between the Temple Mount. In both cases, one who has a nocturnal emission cannot enter those frameworks, but needs to go through the purification process beforehand. The military camp is similar to the Temple Mount. In both contexts, God's presence is manifest. In the temple, God's presence is an expression of the love and the intimacy between God and the Jewish people. In the context of the military camp, God's presence is an expression of the protection, of the salvation which God will bring upon the Jewish people. When God's presence is close, when God is in an intimate relationship with the people, there are expectations, high standards of behavior. In last week's Parshat Shoftim, we spoke about warfare. And there was one section which I did not mention, which is that when the Jews are about to go in battle, there is a priest known as the Mashuach Milchama who addresses the people and says to them, "Do not be afraid, because God is with you and will save you, deliver you from your enemies." This is in chapter 20. If we want God's presence to be in our midst, then we have to respond by behaving according to a higher standard. And this expectation is in sharp contrast with what typifies military camps. And perhaps to illustrate this, the word that's used for going to battle is kitetse, when you go out. One can understand going out in a very literal sense. You go out of your home, you go out of your country to wage war. And unfortunately, we saw this in the past few weeks, as soldiers left Israel to go fight in Lebanon. But the idea of going out has a much more profound understanding. And that is, when people wage war, they go out of their normative context. Warfare is a framework where the general rules of civility break down. What people would generally not do in normal civilian life, they allow themselves to do in a military camp. And that is why the Torah tells us it is important for us to maintain our standards, perhaps even to raise our standards in the military camp. It is important for us to not tend to our bodily needs, but to realize there is a place distinct, separate, where you go to the bathroom. It is important that sexuality, preoccupation with sexuality, those wicked little thoughts, should not then lead to seminal emissions in the military camp. And even the idea of guard yourself from evil matters, or even more so, evil speech. It is important for us to speak cleanly, in a manner of holiness, in a way that reflects our human dignity when we're in a military context. And the reason for all that is that by recognizing the presence of God in our midst, we also recognize our human dignity. We also realize what separates us from animals, so that we don't become brutes who are preoccupied with the exercise of force and power, who have no sense of constraint. Going to war is very much interwoven with the whole panoply of human relations in civilian life in our parsha. As a way of saying, the way we behave in our civilian lives will impact on how we act in the military camp, and vice versa. To the degree to which we cultivate our human dignity, our sense of respect in civilian life, that will be reflected in our military camp. And conversely, if we maintain high standards in our military camp, it will be reflected when we go back to our normal lives. Warfare is a test of our morality. The test is not only in terms of how we relate to our enemies. The test, first and foremost, is how we relate to ourselves, the degree to which we conduct ourselves in a dignified manner. Hence, if I go back to the beginning of the parsha, there is a very interesting Hasidic interpretation which says, when you go out to battle against your enemy, this is not referring to the external enemy, but rather to the enemy within. And in true Jewish fashion, the pshat and the drash reinforce each other. Situations of war, when there are external enemies, force us to confront who we really are, force us to confront, as the rabbis say, our evil inclination. And this finds expression in the beginning of the parsha. The first thing which the Torah discusses in our parsha is the law of the captive woman, or as it is known in Hebrew, Eshet Yifat Toar. And we're told in chapter 21, verse 11, after the Torah says you will go to war and take a captive, it says you will see in captivity a beautiful woman. You will want her, eagerly want her, and take her for your wife. But then the Torah has a whole procedure that we have to go through before she can be taken as a wife. She has to be brought into the home. Her hair has to be shaved off. Her nails have to be grown long. She has to remove those very attractive clothes that she put on to allure, to seduce the invading armies. In your house, the worst in her appearance, her external appearance, should be brought out before you. She should sit in your house and spend a month mourning her father and her mother. On the one hand, this seems to be a very cruel way of dealing with a captive, shaving her hair, disheveling her, in many ways stripping her of her human dignity. And yet, on the other hand, the way the rabbis understood this is that by doing so, it removes the element of her external beauty and forces the one who took her captive to look at her through different lenses, to see her humanity, so that if he should nevertheless decide to take her to be his wife, it will not be out of lust, but out of a sense of intimacy, out of a sense of relationship, as a way of somehow peeling the external layers and trying to get at who that person really is. But there is also another option, that in the aftermath of this ordeal, as it says in verse 14, chapter 21, that perhaps this person will decide not to marry her. In such a case, the Torah says, send her away to herself. Do not sell her. Do not in any way mistreat her, because you have already abused her. From the rabbinic perspective, the ideal would be to send this woman back, to let her go, be who she needs to be. And the rabbis, in fact, see the juxtaposition of the following sections as part of an perhaps inevitable process, which is very problematic. And to put it in the following terminology, If a man sees a woman in the context of war and lusts for her and marries her, and even if, and this is my addendum, even if he sees another side of her during that month that she's in his house and nevertheless decides to marry her, but it could be that the lust is so powerful that that is ultimately what defines their relationship. And hence the rabbis say that will lead to chapter 21, verse 15, which says that if a man has two wives, one that he loves, one that he hates, ultimately the relationship of lust will lead to a relationship of hate. This can also be seen later on in another halakha, which is in chapter 22, verses 13 through 19. A halakha known as Motzi Shemra, where it says, what if a man takes a woman and comes upon her and hates her, and then afterwards libels her, basically saying she was not a virgin when he married her. And this can be understood as well as being an example of a situation of where this man is lusting, has all kinds of fantasies of what it'll be like the first night, is disappointed, where the disappointment results in hatred, hatred that then leads to libel. But it doesn't end there, because it seems that the hatred of the woman is extended then to perhaps the hatred of her child. So that in chapter 21, verse 15 and 16, although this woman has a child who's a firstborn, he is not favored by his father and given the rights that are coming to him. Or at least that is what the father does not want to do. But even worse, in the next section, chapter 18, Ki yele ish ben sorer umoreh, if a man will have a rebellious child. And the rabbis say, when a relationship is created out of lust, it leads to a situation of hatred. The hatred eventually produces children who are rebellious. In the case of the captive woman, the woman is not treated with dignity. She's treated as an object. An object in a power struggle, where the victor wants to take the spoils. In such a situation, there is no relationship. And in the vacuum, it inevitably leads to hatred. And hatred which is not just limited to the woman, but to her child. And a hatred which then boomerangs in rebellious children. In the parsha, we end with remembering Amalek. And although I have spoken about this in the past, I would like to look at Amalek in the context of this parsha, and specifically at one verse, chapter 25, verse 18. After saying, remember what Amalek did to you, it says, what did he actually do to you? Asher karcha baderech. Two explanations. He cooled you off on the way, or he casually encountered you. And he tailed you, all those that straggled behind you. And you were tired and weary, and did not fear God. In the past we've spoken about Amalek reflecting an ideology that has to do with chance, randomness, as opposed to purpose and destiny. And that's related to the word karcha, mikre, chance event. Similar to the idea of mikre lailai, the chance event at night in the military camp that produces the seminal emission. Amalek attacks the stragglers, the weary. The ideology of chance is also an ideology of power, of exploitation, of taking advantage, of weaknesses. And ultimately, this is all connected with V'lo Yare Elohim. He did not fear God. Fear not in the sense of being afraid, but fear in the sense of awe. Amalek does not recognize the awesomeness of God, does not recognize the higher authority of God. But in not recognizing God, Amalek also does not recognize the godliness in himself and in others. By not fearing God, he is also not in awe of man. It is very interesting that the rabbis see the expression V'lo Yare Elohim as being ambiguous, meaning it is not only Amalek who did not fear God, but it may very well have been the Jewish people who also, at that moment, did not fear God. And if we look at the actual story in Exodus, in chapter 17, when it happened, Amalek attacks the Jewish people after a certain incident where the Jewish people complained about not having any water. And basically, if we look in Exodus at chapter 16, verse 7, they named the place Massa Umrivah because of the strife of the people of Israel, and Massa related to the word Nasot, test, because of the fact that the people tested God by saying, is God really in our midst? Amalek is an external manifestation of what internally is going on in the Jewish people. Amalek does not fear God and attacks the weakness of the Jews, who at that moment also do not fear God. Amalek does not recognize the human dignity and is not in awe of man when the Jewish people do not recognize their dignity and their awesomeness. So that if I go back to the beginning of the parsha with the Hasidic comment that I mentioned earlier, our parsha speaks about battles and military camps, and that is certainly the pshat. But the deeper meaning is that the real battles are within our camp. The real battles are within each individual. The real battles are within our society. How much do we fear God in our personal lives? How much do we fear God in terms of how we interact with other members of society? How much does that fear of God inspire us and give us a sense of the awesomeness of who we are and who the others around us are, and force us to aspire to a higher level of behavior, to a higher standard? Throughout the book of Dvarim, we are told not to be afraid when we engage in battle, because God is with us. God is there to deliver us from our enemies. Before we fight the external enemies, we have to be able to fight our internal enemies. We have to be able to struggle with ourselves. But that same God is with us to enable us to triumph. We are now in the month of Elul, anticipating the high holidays. Elul is an unbelievable opportunity which is given to us to come back, to reconnect. Reconnect with God, reconnect with ourselves. Tshuva, return. Recognizing our human dignity is not easy. Living up to standards of behavior can be a daunting task, but we have the promise, the guarantee, that if we take that first step, God will carry us the rest of the way. It's that first step which is very, very difficult. May we be able to grab the unbelievable opportunity that is given us this month to be able to make that first step, to be able to go step by step, to be able to struggle and triumph. This these past few weeks we've been speaking about the wars against our enemies. For the moment, the war against our enemy, the external enemy, is on the back burner. Right now, the challenge is confronting ourselves. May we know how to be able to acknowledge our dignity, to be able to overcome our weaknesses, to be empowered, in awe, and as a result of that, may we merit to not have to fight the external enemy, but to perhaps bring them to a recognition of who they should be. So as we say in the Tefillah of Rosh Hashanah, may all of humanity create one bond in service of God. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated. Please send your emails to podcast@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.